Last day of 2024. Welcome, everybody, to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Heard this and every single day of the work week when it's not a holiday week from 6 to 9 a.m. Your comments, your questions, your commentary, always welcome. You can call or text, same number, 206-421-5757.
Game plan for the new year. Ready, John?
206-421-5757.
2025, everybody, you're the snake. For us, John, Carlson Commute means pushing boundaries and also learning to navigate new challenges. It's going to be a busy year for this morning show.
Oh, it's going to be a very busy show because on the one hand, we're going to be playing offense in Washington, D.C. We've got so many problems to fix that have cropped up in the last few years. And at the state level, we're going to be playing defense. We've got so much harm to prevent a new regime, the one-party Democrat regime in Olympia. So, yeah, we're going to be busy. And a lot of other things going on as well. Again, whether it's local, regional, state, or national, even international, the John Carlson Show going to give you a perspective. You're not going to hear in a lot of other places. We have a lot of local, state, and national and international content today. As there are a lot of things going on, I want to start with that horrible crash of the 737 in South Korea. Again, 179 people dead. Two flight attendants sitting in the very back of the plane managed to survive. I'm not sure about their conditions or the extent of their injuries. Here is ABC's reporter Britt Clement in South Korea.
New video of the charred remains of the Boeing 737 that slammed into an airport wall in South Korea, killing nearly everyone on board. A team of investigators in hazmat suits was seen sifting through the debris field.
And you can see just how quickly the debris was shot out of that plane, how catastrophic it was. You can see the twisted seats, in-flight magazines, bits of clothing, safety cards.
Investigators are now looking at this image, appearing to show a puff of smoke coming from one of the engines of the Jeju air flight, suggesting a bird strike. Just before attempting to land, the pilots called, "Mayday, mayday, mayday, bird strike, going around." Minutes later, the plane makes contact with the runway with no landing gear down, skidding at a high speed into a concrete wall at the end of the runway and erupting in a ball of fire.
We don't know what happened in those 4 minutes between when the crew declared an emergency and the crash itself. Why did they make the decisions that they made? Why land fast? Why land with the gear up? And why land so far down the runway they weren't able to stop the aircraft?
It comes amid new questions about that concrete wall at the end of the runway, which protects a communication antenna. Some experts are asking why the wall was positioned there and why it wasn't made out of a material that would break apart more easily. The only survivors of the 181 people on board were two flight attendants seated in the very rear of the plane. One, a 33-year-old man, telling doctors he doesn't remember being rescued. The other, a woman, reportedly in stable condition. Heartbroken families have been gathering at the airport as they await any information about their loved ones.
Well, there's more information we have. Let's take you to the flight itself as it was encountering difficulty. They're about a half hour behind schedule. The pilot was preparing to land at his destination in South Korea, the southwestern part of South Korea, when the control tower warned him about flocks of birds that were in the area. Just 2 minutes later, just before 9 o'clock in the morning, the pilot reported a bird strike and an emergency. He told the air traffic control tower at the airport, it was Muan International, he would do a go-around, meaning he was not going to land initially. He would abort his first landing and circle in the air and prepare for a second attempt. But apparently, the emergency worsened and he did not have enough time to go all the way around. So just 60 seconds later, the pilot, who's no rookie, he has almost 7,000 flight hours, was approaching the runway from the opposite direction. And 3 minutes after that, the 737 slammed into a concrete structure off the southern end of the runway. And again, almost everyone on board, 179 people, most of them South Koreans returning home after Christmas vacation in Thailand, were killed. Footage of the plane landing shows that it's skidding down the runway without its landing gear deployed. So it's basically just on its belly. And the other thing that's interesting is it doesn't seem to show that it was slowing down before it slammed into this concrete structure. Now, it landed on the runway, skidded off the runway, and went another 800 feet before that happened. So until the black box is examined in some detail, they don't know why the pilot was in such a hurry to land, why he couldn't go all the way around rather than just halfway around and basically came in the wrong way. Also, when pilots have to do what's called a belly landing without your landing gear, they usually try and dump extra fuel and give extra time on the ground for emergency crews to stand by. But something happened to that plane where the pilot didn't think he had time to do either one of those things. So they don't know if he lost power in both engines. They don't know whether the decision he made to land the way he did was pilot error or catastrophic mechanical failure. So those are the unanswered questions, and that's what, you know, the that's what all of the investigation is focusing on.
John, quick word about bird strikes too. Feel proud, everybody. SeaTac Airport happens to be the world leader when it comes to technology to avoid bird strikes. They have what's called a Raptor Strike Avoidance Program, actually a crew that will trap birds and take them up north and release them in Skagit County. And now the question is, what do we have at the other airports around the world? Do they have this kind of technology? Bird strike still the worst when it becomes in a situation of flying a jetliner.
Yeah, now the plane that crashed was not a 737 MAX. It was actually the generation previous to the 730 MAX. It's 737-800. So when we learn more, we will make sure that we pass that information to you. But I wanted to give you an idea of what was happening from the perspective of the pilot up there. It is 12 and a half minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning, the last day, 31st day of December. The Commute with Carlson. And again, a lot of other things we want to get into, both local and national. It looks like this civil war that was declared, MAGA, Make America Great Again, supporters of Donald Trump breaking into a civil war over an immigration visa program called the H-1B visa. It looks like there's already a truce that's being called. And we'll tell you who apparently was eager to call a truce and to clarify his position on H-1B visas. I'll give you a hint. He makes cars and rocket ships. That's coming up here on The Commute with Carlson this morning. Also, want to get into this stabbing that took place in Seattle, 12th and Jackson. This is an area known as Little Saigon. And this was the reason I wanted to bring this up is this apparently was a completely unprovoked attack. The stabbing victim was actually in pretty rough shape, but is now expected to recover. And the assailant is a young woman, which kind of makes this unusual. Here's Como 4's Mary Nam.
A man is recovering in the hospital with serious injuries after what police are calling an unprovoked attack in the Chinatown International District. Police say a woman punched and stabbed a 22-year-old man in the lower back at 12th and Jackson. The violence has already frustrated neighbors on edge.
We can't sustain this. I mean, you know, many of us are small business owners, and we noticed this year in 2024 that our business has dropped off because of negative perception.
The mayor's office says there has been an estimated 27% decrease in violent crime in the area since last month when the city expanded its downtown activation team to the CID in Little Saigon that involves targeted police patrols and area cleanups.
Now, here would be an interesting little experiment. I think there should be a poll taken of the people there. Do you feel safer? Do you feel safer here? Because reported crime is showing a clear, noticeable decrease. Do you, if you live in and around the Little Saigon area of Seattle, it's basically at the edge, the southern edge of Capitol Hill and the western edge of Chinatown International District, do you feel safer here? Or is this yet another example of how government figures don't match the reality on the ground? Here's what I think. I think that Little Saigon is probably more dangerous and that more and more people are just not reporting a lot of the things that 5 years ago they would report. I think a lot of crime is just being ignored, shrugged at, or people are just leaving and avoiding the area. And when people avoid an area, yeah, crime usually goes down, right? But let us remember, this is the same Little Saigon where just 2 weeks ago, Metro announced they were no longer stopping at a bus stop right in this very vicinity. It's just too dangerous. Too much violence, too much chaos and bedlam. Here's Como 4's Jackie Kent pointing out that where this 22-year-old woman allegedly stabbed someone for no reason whatsoever, Boy, talk about confounding stereotypes. This is where they've had other unprovoked attacks.
This is the same area where a mass stabbing last month shook this neighborhood. Then Metro bus service stopped nearby due to safety concerns for bus drivers and riders. Business owners here tell me that has helped make this area cleaner and quieter, but they are calling on the city for more help as they struggle to get customers back.
Well, one more problem with Metro Transit. When the buses don't roll, the place allegedly becomes a little cleaner and safer. That's not a good sign, is it? By the way, I said the 22-year-old woman was the alleged attacker. They haven't actually got her in custody. Was the victim was a 22-year-old man. The woman is still at large. So this is another problem that shows everything going wrong in Seattle. Mentally ill people, not involuntarily committed, who probably have a long criminal history, combination of mental illness, drugs, and criminal activity. Public transit being a magnet for trouble, rather than being a place known where you can't misbehave. You can't bother or harass or intimidate or attack other people. And then you heard the business owners saying, hey, we're losing business because people are no longer coming here. Like I said, Seattle's got a long way to dig out of here. It is 20 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning on our final show of 2024, December 31st edition of the John Carlson Show. Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner with the first social media sweep of the morning. And speaking of which, I always like it when Mark Christopher brings in his record player.
You can hear the needle,
78
right?
RPM.
Just amazing what Phil and I found in the basement in some of these boxes. There are so many songs in reference
Bing Crosby.
To New Year, Happy New Year. A few of them featured this morning.
All right. It is the 31st day of December, 25 and a half minutes after 6 in the morning. Philip J. Vandervoort III with the first social media sweep of the morning. Go, Phil.
I have two stories that parallel what you were talking about in the last segment. One about near catastrophe of an airplane carrying the Gonzaga men's basketball team. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort on Friday. The Gonzaga University men's basketball team was landing in Los Angeles at LAX International Airport. And, you know, after you land, you got a taxi back to the terminal. And somewhere along the line after the landing and the attempt to turn across another runway where planes were departing, I think it's a charter. The airline is called Key Lime Air that was carrying the men's basketball team. And it appeared there's video that's coming out now, and I'll give you the air traffic control radio traffic here in just a moment. But air traffic controllers had to tell that charter flight to stop as a much larger plane was barreling down on top of them and just about to go airborne. Here's what it sounded like on the air traffic control.
1346, London Sky, good afternoon. We have 12016. Key Lime, stop, stop, stop.
Key Lime, stop, stop, stop. And the plane did, of course, stop. It's a smaller charter plane, so more like one of those Horizon air jets that you might see out at Payne Field or some of the smaller airports that make the smaller runs back to Yakima or Walla Walla or something like that. The FAA now, according to an Associated Press report, launching an investigation after the private jet carrying the Gonzaga men's basketball team nearly crossed a runway as another flight was taking off. At LAX, but thankfully there, just the close call, everybody's okay. Back in New York City, I mean, we just had the Daniel Penny trial and acquittal a couple of weeks ago, and there have been two attacks on subway riders in the last week, one of them which a woman was killed. She was set on fire, and prosecutors have indicted a Guatemalan citizen in the United States illegally, right?
Yeah.
For burning her alive. There's been another attack.
She was sleeping.
Yeah.
And he, there's actually video this circulating, where he lights her on fire, and then as her clothes are catching fire, he's fanning the flames. You see him fanning the flames. I don't believe he knows who she is.
Yeah.
Again, just another random attack, and she died of third-degree burns.
Yeah. And then a man was discovered with serious burns over his body last Friday at Penn Station, and that comes about a week or a little less than a week after an unidentified woman was set fire and killed on a New York subway. In this latest one, the 67-year-old male victim has survived, is now in stable condition. And the report now from a couple of different news outlets, and I'm looking at a post from the New York TV station WPIX-TV, the Guardian Angels are going to resume patrols on New York City subway cars after these last two attacks. And it was the late 70s.
Yeah, Curtis Sliwa founded
that. Wow.
More than 50 years ago, founded the Guardian Angels, the guys with the red berets who are, are just there to basically show that there's people paying attention, watching. And and he's still at it.
So you just had this story of another unprovoked stabbing attack in Seattle's Little Saigon. And we obviously do not have enough police officers on the street in Seattle. But, you know, here's the past becoming prologue again in New York City as the Guardian Angels are reforming to try and hopefully keep things safe on the New York City subway.
Here is the problem, and that is that mentally ill people, they say, oh, we need to offer them more mental health treatment. Okay, you can offer that, but understand, under our civil libertarian rules, you can get up and leave anytime you don't like listening to what they're telling you. So you can have all the counseling you want, but they assume mentally ill people know when they need help and know when they don't. And if they want to just walk away, they walk away. Mm-hmm. What we need to change are the rules for involuntary commitment when someone is deranged, when someone's seriously mentally ill and in danger of doing something bad to somebody else or something bad to themselves.
Yeah. Next hour on the social media sweep, I'll give you a trivia quiz. What nation ends up becoming the first to celebrate New Year's 2025? I'll give you a hint. It's due south of Hawaii, but it's on the other side of the international dateline.
I'll
tell you about that next hour.
Okay. And when we come back, is there already a truce in this supposed MAGA civil war over the H-1B visa program? We'll explain what that program is all about, why it is so controversial, and why Elon Musk is doing kind of a tap dance now, kind of stepping away from some of his earlier comments as the commute was.
Where it just doesn't work on AM, where you can't hear the lyrics of the Beatles. Woke up, got out of bed, dragged the chrome across my head. You do that tomorrow, John, you're going to get a little bit more money when it comes to a wage.
That's right. The minimum wage is going up.
Yeah.
We're all getting raises.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
All right. You got 37 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning. Speaking of wages, there is a program that is very popular with high-tech employers. It's called the H-1B visa. And on paper, boy, oh boy, what a great program. It is supposed to allow American companies to hire specialized employees from abroad when they have trouble attracting American workers to do this kind of specialized work. Elon Musk once had an H-1B visa. He is an enthusiastic supporter of the H-1B visa program. He said the reason, this is what he's posted on social media, the reason I'm in America with so many critical people who built SpaceX, Tesla, and hundreds of other companies that made America strong is because of H-1B. He said, I will go to war on this issue, the likes of which you cannot possibly comprehend. That is to say, if people try and do away with the H-1B visa program.
And part of the comment you just read is an attribution to a movie called Tropic Thunder with a really outrageous scene involving Tom Cruise as an upset movie executive. And so there was more to it than that, where Elon Musk drops a curse word or two.
Yes.
But it's all in reference to this scene from a really irreverent movie from 16 years ago.
Robert
Tropic
Downey
Thunder.
Jr.
Exactly.
In this movie.
Yeah.
It's a pretty funny movie.
Ben Stiller.
Actually.
So it was kind of a send up of Hollywood epic war movie sort of.
So the media have been waiting to see cracks in the foundation of the Trump coalition. And they instantly started calling this the MAGA Civil War. Well, it doesn't appear to be nearly as much to this war as people thought. It's more of a skirmish, and I think, frankly, more of a misunderstanding. First of all, this is the most important thing you need to know about the H-1B visa program. It is not working as it was designed to work. It's a non-immigrant visa that allows American companies to hire foreign employees in specialty occupations that require specialized knowledge. We're talking certain types of IT and engineering, medicine, mathematics. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Office, branch of the U.S. government, estimates that almost 600,000 people are working in the United States under the H-1B visa category. They allow about 85,000 of these visas every year. Microsoft loves this program. So does Google. But when Elon Musk offered uncritical praise of the H-1B visa program, guess what? He came in for immediate and fierce disagreement and criticism. And now he has offered a clarification. He says, maybe this is a helpful clarification. I am referring to bringing in, via legal immigration, the top 0.1% of engineering talent as being essential for America to keep winning. And this is how the H-1B visa program is often described by its defenders, but it goes way beyond the top 0.1%. But anyway, he says, think of America as a pro sports team that's been winning for a long time and wants to keep winning. And so they bring in, you know, a couple of superstars from abroad. Musk then emphasized the need for reforms to prevent potential abuses. And I would simply point out that we don't need to change the H-1B visa program to prevent potential abuses. We need to change the program to prevent ongoing abuses. What is happening here is that American companies like using the H-1B visa program for a number of reasons. One of them is that when you bring someone in on a visa like this, they are loyal to your company. They can't come in and on an H-1B visa program for Google and then get a better offer from another company and they skedaddle over to that company. So they don't have to worry about competition from within the industry, the employer. Secondly, as we are now learning, they can pay less money. And thirdly, they don't have to make the case that, gee, there's just no Americans around who will do this work. I have been hearing for well over a decade anecdotes about local employees, high-tech employees, who have been laid off so the employer can save money and bring in foreign workers to do their jobs. In a couple of instances, they have been assigned to train the employee taking their place as part of their termination settlement. That's how abusive this program has begun. A man named Robert Sterling put together a series of charts and graphs to show, you know, kind of take an overview of how the H-1B visa program works. He points out that there's more than 800,000 applications a year for the 85,000 visas that are granted. So the demand is high. Now, you would think top 0.1% specialty occupations. Number one, you wouldn't think there'd be 800,000 applications from the top 0.1%, and that these jobs must pay a blank load of money. They must pay serious coin. But they don't. They actually pay less than the average IT wage. The average salary for an H-1B employee visa holder is under $120,000. Again, you would think if you're getting the creme de la creme of the tech world doing high-tech engineering jobs that the average wage would be dramatically higher, but that's not the case. 75% of those jobs pay less than $150,000. What are these jobs? Almost all of them are science, technology, engineering, or math. There are a number of 50,000 of auditors and accountants. And I read that and I said, wait a minute. There's a specialty in auditing and accounting that they can't find Americans to do? As I said, there are a few companies that account for a vast disproportionate number of these H-1B visas. 15 of them, 15 American companies, or 15 companies here in America, have received approval for 20,000 or more applications each. There are a number of heavily of companies that are heavily comprised of Indian, meaning from India, that import H-1B tech workers in large numbers. Again, these are not American companies that need international talent to fill their roles. They're foreign companies that have been founded to place overseas tech workers into the United States as contractors. So that is why this program needs reform. I'll tell you in a moment what those reforms will be. This little kerfuffle, this skirmish, this controversy over the H-1B visa program might very well result in reforms and changes to the H-1B visa program that are long, long overdue. One more reason it's good to have a new, fresh administration coming to town. The John Carlson Show going to town here on the talk radio station of record, 570 KVI. Good morning.
Could never write music, could never read music, but boy, Jimmy could play a song.
Let's see Guy Lombardo top that. Jimi Hendrix. Back in 1969, my goodness, that would make this 55 years old?
Yeah, New Year's Eve, Fillmore East Live, surprise the crowd saying, it's almost New Year's, 1970, I got a song.
55 years ago today. How about that?
Yeah.
It is 54 minutes after 6 o'clock. Okay, so how do we fix the H-1B visa program? Mark Krikorian, Center for Immigration Studies, says the natural move is for the new Trump administration to select visa recipients by salary, highest salary offers, rather than lottery. So if we are truly going to be in keeping with the spirit and the letter of the H-1B visa program, you want your most valuable talent difficult to find, then companies would demonstrate that with a willingness to pay up. And Elon Musk concurs. He says this program can be fixed by raising the minimum salary significantly. So in other words, you're not going to save money by hiring talent from abroad. You may as well hire American workers, only if you're looking for someone who's truly among the elite. Will this program make economic sense to you? They should also add a yearly cost for maintaining the H-1B, making it materially more expensive to hire from overseas than domestically. Musk goes on to say, I've been very clear the program is broken and needs major reform. So if we get major reform that goes in this direction, that is a good thing. That is a good thing. And this little dust up between various warring factions within MAGA was all worth it if this is what we end up with as a reform of the program. Let's get ready for hour number two of The Commute. Hour number two, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning. Thank you for joining me. And as promised, and again, we're going right up to the very brim of 2025, and we still have so much stuff in front of us here, stuff that matters. It's very much unlike your typical year where the holidays, usually things kind of relax a little bit. There isn't as much to talk about. This year, completely different. It's as busy as any month we have had. And it's because there is so much, so many things that matter that have been happening. Of course, this week, on top of all the stuff that's already in the news, of course, the death of former President Jimmy Carter, we talked at some length yesterday about Jimmy Carter, his presidency and his post-presidency. And your comments, of course, always welcome, either by call or by text. 206-421-5757. Scott Jennings from CNN, who I like a lot because he's straightforward, he's sensible, and he's fearless. They always put him on. Well, basically, CNN is doing what other networks should do, and that is they have people around the table who actually have different viewpoints. Now, at MSNBC, their idea of a balanced panel is to bring on anti-Trump Republicans to balance anti-Trump Democrats. That's not much balance. CNN, to their credit, at least on Abby Phillips' show, has Scott Jennings. Usually there sometimes is another conservative. Now, they're outnumbered, but that's okay because they've got better ammunition. And Scott Jennings was asked to sum up Jimmy Carter's life, and there's kind of a narrative that's developing, which is, yeah, his presidency wasn't too successful, but by golly, what a great post-presidency. What a great ex-president he was. And there were some great things that he did in terms of spotlighting Habitat for Humanity, actually helping to build homes, teaching Sunday school, which, again, he didn't just do every once in a while when cameras were nearby. He was doing it much of the year, teaching Sunday school. But when he went public, when he got political, he did much more harm than good much of the time. And we talked about one example of that was Israel. And Scott Jennings says, you know, it went beyond just Israel. Have a listen.
Well, let me preface my take by offering condolences to the Carter family and on his death. He was obviously one of the most unique post-presidencies we ever have because he lived so long and he did so much. That having been said, he was a terrible president. That's why he lost in a landslide after his one term. And if it's possible, I think he was even a worse ex-president because of his meddling in U.S. foreign policy, because of his saddling up to dictators around the world, because of his vehement views, anti-Israel views, and more than dabbling in anti-Semitism over the years. He often vexed Democrats. Obama didn't even have him speak at his 08 convention. He put Bill Clinton in a terrible foreign policy box on a North Korea nuclear issue. I think he was a guy who had a huge ego and believed that he was uniquely positioned to do all these things even after the American people had roundly and soundly rejected his leadership. So I respect people who run for president and get elected president, but in his particular case, I think he time and again proved why he was never suited for the office in the first place.
Okay. Here's the common thread between that ties together his presidency and his post-presidency. So Jimmy Carter had terrible judgment in sizing up foreign adversaries. Terrible judgment. He was perpetually naive. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One I gave you yesterday. When he was president, his administration warned against, famously in a commencement speech at Notre Dame in 1977, warned against Americans, quote, inordinate fear of communism, close quote. Now, this was during the Cold War, at a time when the Vietnam War had ended, America was kind of pulling back from foreign commitments and, you know, dealing with problems here at home. And the Soviets began pushing their agenda forward, which was to control countries, replace governments in other countries with regimes that were loyal to and supported by the Kremlin. And when Jimmy Carter said that, they stepped up the pace. And all of a sudden we had, you know, communist revolutionaries, always euphemistically named as, you know, rebels or reformers by the mainstream media. But the Sandinista regime were communists. And we had Angola. And we had, you know, Afghanistan. And when the Afghanistan regime was not pliable enough, they assassinated the head of that government and invaded the country and installed another regime. The Soviet's empire actually grew during the Carter administration. That was part of the Carter legacy. Too trusting of the Soviet regime, not recognizing their nature. They also were well along the way to a nuclear arms treaty called SALT II, Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, that tilted heavily in favor of the Soviet Union, and Ronald Reagan ran for president on a vow to not move forward with that treaty. So that was one country, but it wasn't just, oh, he had a blind spot to the Russians. He had a blind spot toward the Iranians. And he misjudged the hostility and the philosophical anti-Western, anti-American nature of the Islamic fundamentalist regime of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And that culminated, as we all know from the history books, some of us were around and on campuses, when they seized the American embassy and took 44 American embassy employees as hostages, which is, of course, an act of war. I was on campus at the University of Washington. There were actually spontaneous pro-American demonstrations breaking out. And there were college professors who, you know, had lived through, you know, anti-American rallies on college campuses throughout the 60s and early 70s, who said, I never thought I'd live to see a pro-American rally. But that's what happened after the Iranians seized the hostages. But they did so only after some terrible miscalculations, because Jimmy Carter, again, misunderstood the nature of that regime. Then he flies to North Korea and does a little freelancing negotiation of nuclear arms with the North Koreans, which this happened during the Bill Clinton administration, which their administration did not ask him to do and did not approve of. I think we all know that the result of that was a nuclear North Korea. And it's because Jimmy Carter did not understand the nature of that communist cult regime, the Kim family, that ran North Korea and still does. And then he was being interviewed by Piers Morgan some time ago, where he said that Hamas should be trusted as a bargaining partner to recognize the existence of Israel if only they would adjust their borders back to where they were in 1967. If only they will do that, then Hamas could be trusted. Again, the man's naivety is frightful. After all these years of getting it wrong, you would think he'd say, boy, what am I missing here? What am I doing wrong? And here he is calling for Israel to voluntarily give up territory so that Hamas will be nicer to them. Now, let's bear in mind, Israel had already given up territory to Hamas. Gaza used to be Israel. It was Israeli territory. Israel walked away. They forcibly uprooted Israeli civilians from Gaza and said, get out. We can't guarantee your safety anymore. And the people in Gaza elected Hamas to represent them. Hamas, you'll recall, was so militant they broke away from Yasser Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization. And, of course, Jimmy Carter was naive about him, too, about Yasser Arafat, recognizing that he could turn on and off terrorism like a spigot. So Jimmy Carter's post-presidency, well, you know, when he would go around the world observing elections, like he did in 1990 in Nicaragua, when the Reagan administration started making life difficult for the Sandinistas, they had to cry uncle and call an election, and they lost the election. Jimmy Carter was one of the monitors of that election. Okay, that's good, Jimmy. But on North Korea, Israel, Iran, the Cold War, he was a genuine obstacle to peace and to freedom. And that should not be forgotten. As much as I appreciate his work for Habitat for Humanity and the Sunday school lessons, his Christianity and whatnot, you know, that is commendable. But as a political public figure, oh my goodness, his post-presidency was every bit as much a failure as his presidency. It is coming up on 18 minutes. After 7 o'clock, The Commute with Carlson. Still to come on The Commute, a Wall Street Journal story on how the Biden administration may have suppressed dissenting views that supported the lab leak theory of COVID. Now, understand, the public health community and the news media, curiously, seemed absolutely adamant that the what was called the Wuhan virus, which originated in the hometown of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which conducts studies and research on COVID viruses, did not originate from the lab. Instead, it was likely a wet market. And when evidence emerged to the contrary, the Biden administration, the, quote, public health community and the media seem to go to extremes to tamp down any attempt to hold the Chinese government responsible for COVID-19. In fact, they even called it COVID-19 to take out the word China. Most viruses are often named for where they originate, like Ebola. But China was adamant that it was racist if you did that regarding COVID-19, and the media immediately said, well, we're not racist. We'll prove it. We'll stop using that terminology. But what the journal is reporting here shows how big tech and big government and big media really acted in concert to try and suppress credible and, in my view, persuasive evidence that you bet COVID originated at that lab. It is 21 minutes after 7 o'clock. We'll get to that and the incoming Ferguson administration's dalliance with expanding gun restrictions here in the state of Washington. All that as the Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Are you reeling in the years? Stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years?
Oh, we're reeling in.
Stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of
reeling in 2024. Thank you, Steely Dan. 25 and a half minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning. Philip J. Vandenberg, the third, standing by with the social media sweep. Go, Phil.
That's right. Adios, 2024. And I said that I'd quiz you two, so put on your thinking caps for the first nation that celebrates 2025 with the new year. It happened a few hours ago, so this country's well into 2025. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. So my hint for you is that this is directly south of Hawaii, but there's a carve out in the way the international time zone boundary is created, and it puts this nation onto the western side of the Pacific instead of the central or the eastern side. Do you know this country, John and Mark?
I know it, but go ahead, John, you first.
Oh, wow. I thought I might have stumped both of you.
Well,
don't look.
No, it's an island in the Pacific,
yes.
Kind of an atoll,
yep.
Really.
Yep.
And I'm not sure how to pronounce it. It begins with a K.
Yep, yeah. You got it. Kiribati.
Okay. Kiribati, okay.
So yeah. About 120,000 people live there. But they were the first to celebrate New Year's, 2025. Let's see. We've got a couple more cities here.
Seven and a half hours ago.
So what country is that by itself, or is that like a part of?
Yeah, are they a part of
it? It is its own country, about 120,000 citizens.
Oh.
So, yeah.
So it's
in the region known as Micronesia.
Micronesia.
Okay. That's probably the more helpful geographic locator. Seoul, South Korea, big city. They 27 minutes ago celebrated New Year's, and then we're getting into Western Australia and Taipei will be one of the next. Taiwan and Taipei will be the next to celebrate New Year's here in about 30 minutes. So those are
they
a couple
asked
other.
China when are you guys ringing in the New Year, and the response was when we damn well choose to.
Yeah, I guess so.
We'll let you know.
Yeah, I think we got to wait a little bit longer for Ulaanbaatar. I'm still looking for Mongolia. Yeah, Ulaanbaatar.
Okay, so wait.
We got about a half an hour, Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia.
Which is the last country?
Basically, Hawaii, I believe.
Huh?
Unalaska, Alaska, at the tip of the Aleutian Islands. Yeah, so that's one. And let me see if there are a couple of others. Yeah, Honolulu, Hawaii would be one of the last. And then in the southern hemisphere, the Cook Islands, Rarotonga would be some of the last.
Okay, so I thought it would be like American Samoa.
I can
somewhere in the south
around.
Area.
Yeah. I've got Alofi in Niue, is really in the central Pacific. That's another one. I'm looking around. Yeah, I don't see that one. Baker Island, U.S. minor outlying islands would be after in the same time zone as Hawaii. Midway, of course, famous World War II battle area.
No, I misspoke with the American Samoa. So, they would be closer to among the first.
So
all right.
Yeah.
So we go.
So there's that. Now we can get into some news. Bill Malusian, the Fox News reporter who covers a lot of immigration border issues, U.S.-Mexico.
Better than anyone.
He posted this yesterday. ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, has terminated two programs that gave taxpayer-funded social services to illegal aliens who have been released into the U.S. and they were canceled. This was all terminated and canceled, he says, because of immense cost and the ineffectiveness of these programs. So this was done now at the by the Biden administration, but it obviously the time that it happens with so close to Donald Trump being ready to take office, the timing is certainly curious. He writes, illegal aliens in one program only had a 2% higher compliance rate than those not in it, despite tens of millions of taxpayer dollars being spent on NGOs. These are non-government organizations, usually nonprofit types, to assist the illegal immigrants with things like psychosocial and behavioral health support.
Yeah, that'll do it. That'll solve the problems.
Way to go. Way to go. And then I do have one more here. Governor Inslee. Governor Inslee posted about Jimmy Carter's passing. And, of course, Inslee never missing an opportunity to try and make it political. He writes, there are many reasons to reflect on the legacy of former President Jimmy Carter. One is the vision he had for renewable energy that's now being realized. Reagan took down Carter's White House solar panels, but now they are sprouting up all over the country. And Todd Myers, of course, who has the receipts on stuff that Jay Inslee is up to, Todd Myers from the Washington Policy Center, responded to Governor Inslee's post and said, so at Jay Inslee appears to think that the solar panels of 1981 are similar to those that are still heavily subsidized in 2024. Is it any wonder that over a dozen years, Inslee failed to meet virtually all of his own climate targets?
Oh, point set and match, Todd Myers. Very well said. All right. It is coming up on 7:30. John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, second half of the show.
A little bit of story of New Year's on this one. You were always a fan of Three Dog Night. Yeah.
I'm wondering why
mm-hmm.
a group with over 20 top 20 hits
mm-hmm.
is not on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah. And another part of the criteria is, you know, contribution to rock and roll and new things. As we see history, and a lot of kids ask about, what's this big thing about always TV of Times Square? You know, Ryan Seacrest is there. Dick Clark was there for years. Mm-hmm. Thank Three Dog Night for the idea. See if you remember this. Phil, you might have been too young. New Year's Eve, 1972, ABC decided to do a special.
Now, that was in the era when New Year's Eve shows were like Guy Lombardo.
Exactly. So something new for the kids. Three Dog Night did a New Year's Eve party on the Queen Mary there in Long Beach, California. It was carried live on ABC. Al Green was a part of it. I remember that. I had all the kids over. We had a popcorn. Mom and Dad were like, yeah, you guys, we got to watch this. Blood, Sweat, and Tears was a part of the show, but the headliner and those in charge was Three Dog Night. Just before midnight, they went live to Times Square to check in with Dick Clark. He was just there as a reporter and rock and roll great, of course, from American Bandstand. So he was like telling everybody, well, here we are, Times Square, there's the big ball, and you can see the big crowd, and they got a few little music groups going on here, and isn't this great? Let's just watch it come down and bring in the new year. And then they went back to the Queen Mary. That is where Dick Clark and ABC got an idea. Maybe we should take a rock show and start something called New Year's Eve Rockin' with Dick Clark.
New Year's Rockin' Eve with Dick Clark.
There you go. 1972 bringing in 1973. And then people think, well, Joy to the World's a song to play for New Year's to recall the great contribution of Three Dog Night and ABC to bring that whole idea still alive today.
I remember watching New Year's Rockin' Eve 1976 with my grandparents, thinking to myself, man, what a loser social life I had.
There were some great nights, though. I remember Chicago set one of the greatest gigs they ever did, and first time they ever wore tuxedos.
Very good. All right. It is coming up on 7:38 on the John Carlson Show. Jonathan Turley has a wonderful column about a Wall Street Journal report. Think about that. He's writing a column about an article that I'm now talking about on the radio. It is a report on how the FBI and top experts were disinvited, excluded from a critical briefing of President Biden about the origins of what we call COVID-19, or what was then being called the Wuhan flu. Not only were they excluded, but government scientists were warned when they were citing evidence that led them to believe that it leaked from a lab in Wuhan, that they were, quote, off the reservation, close quote. Now, the Chinese government has been trying to downplay its role in the pandemic since it was discovered. It ended up killing 7 million people around the world, more than 1.2 million in this country. But it was when Donald Trump, president at the time, described it as the China virus and said that he believed it emerged from the Wuhan Institute of Virology lab located in Wuhan, that for the media and Democrats and the public health community, which is overwhelmingly liberal, dismissing the lab theory became almost an article of faith. But the FBI researchers had concluded that the lab theory was the most credible explanation. Their lead researcher was Dr. Jason Bannon, and Dr. Bannon was kept out of the meeting, and their opposing research was ignored. So in other words, Joe Biden was given one set of facts that were cherry-picked to make it look like that the virus was natural and must have come from animals to humans in a wet market located in that same city of Wuhan, China. Defense Department experts John Hardam, Robert Cutlip, and Jean-Paul Chrétien had conducted a genomic analysis that found evidence of human manipulation of the virus, which of course would mean it had to have come from a lab. It concluded it was done using a specific technique developed by the Chinese at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. They suggested that the Chinese appeared to have altered the spike protein that enables the virus to enter the human body. In other words, it was no longer just a virus passed between bats. It had now developed a gain of function operation and could enter humans as well. They were reportedly told to stop sharing their work. At the same time, letters and articles dismissing the lab theory were organized for public consumption. So a campaign was developing within the highest reaches of government to dismiss the lab theory. People who had evidence that the lab theory was correct were told to keep it to themselves or were disinvited from sharing their evidence. So you have researchers from the Defense Department and from the FBI who believed that the lab leak theory made sense. that it was the most plausible explanation. And that their evidence, instead of being part of the public debate, was stifled. And then you had, you know, the usual suspects, CNN, MSNBC, saying, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory about the lab leak. Oh, it made no sense. The New York Times science and health reporter, Apoorva Mandavilli, started calling on reporters not to mention the lab theory because it was racist. So what we now know is that the lab leak theory most likely was the correct explanation for the origins of COVID-19. And what Jonathan Turley pointed out is big tech, big government, and big media were all operating off of each other in an effort to develop a culture of intolerance toward the lab leak theory. The LA Times star columnist Michael Hiltzik wrote a column saying the COVID lab leak claim isn't just an attack on science, it is a threat to public health. Wow. And what Turley concludes is he said one of the saddest aspects of the story is that many of these figures in government, academia, and the media were not necessarily trying to shield China. Some were motivated by their investment in the narrative. Others were drawn by the political and personal benefits that came from joining the mob against a minority of scientists who, again, now appear to have been correct, like so much else we've learned about the whole culture of COVID. And the people who were calling the shots were almost uniformly either wrong, outright wrong, or they were taking things way too far. It is coming up here on 746, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Here is something I'd like to do for the final hour of the show. 2024, we've been talking about, you know, politics, culture, business, the economy, even sports, you know, at the local, state, national, international level. Been trying to cover it all. In 2024, though, what was noteworthy in your life? What happened in your life that was noteworthy? Something you may have accomplished, an obstacle you may have overcome, a huge development in your life. Go ahead and think on that and text me what changed in your life in 2024. Text me your comments at 206-421-5757. We'll have a little fun with this. I'll tell you a couple of things that changed in my life in 2024. Again, that's 206-421-5757. It is Boeing time on The Commute with Carlson, 747. Show Talk Radio 570 KVI. Steve calling from Montana this morning on The Commute. Steve, good morning. How are you?
Hey, John. How are you? My name is Steve.
Go for it.
Hey, listening to your last segment about Dr. Turley, that made me want to ask a question. So with all of the subterfuge and the hiding of this stuff, You know, how do you think it affects the 70 of us who were fired from the Seattle Fire Department for not getting the COVID shot? Most of us received a religious exemption from getting the shot, and then they just summarily fired us anyway, in contrary to federal and state law. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of the public opinion, they think, oh, you're anti-vaxxers, you're this, that, and the other thing. Most of the public in Seattle don't realize that this was manufactured. The disease was manufactured, and the the hype around it was manufactured, as you just said.
Well,
and so
and here's the other thing, is that most firefighters and law enforcement and EMTs, and for that matter, ferry boat employees who were fired, they'd already had COVID. They'd been exposed.
Well, I know I did. I know I'd had COVID, and I actually proved that to the administration of the Seattle Fire Department with medical documentation.
Yeah, so you had already been inoculated from within against COVID.
Anthony Fauci's words were, if you've had the disease, you've had the best vaccine available.
Yeah, and, you know, and we then learned that having the vaccine did not guarantee you wouldn't get COVID. I mean, I had the vaccine. I got the full thing of vaccine. I got COVID at least twice that I know of.
Well, the simple fact, and this is documented in our lawsuit, and I mean, we have tons of this detailed, boring stuff to read through. But the simple fact is that the rate of COVID infection skyrocketed in the Seattle Fire Department amongst vaccinated firefighters after the 18th of October,
Here's my position as time grows short here. My position very simply is anyone who was fired should be offered their job back. You should have been offered your job back 2 years ago. And you should be rehired, and I hope the new year brings some sort of change. But all of these people who were not vaccinated, who didn't receive vaccination, that doesn't mean they weren't protected from COVID. And we now learn the vaccine was vastly oversold, and that natural immunity was disregarded almost entirely, which was itself the definition of anti-science. All right, it is time for hour number three of the Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning.
A little technical error here, one last one of the year.
I guess.
Again.
The computer ate our intro.
Welcome back, everybody. This is how you know the show is live. It is the last hour of the last Commute with Carlson for 2024 on this 31st day of December. Welcome, everybody. It's been a wonderful year we've had, and we're looking forward to another great year. If it's possible, even a better year than the one that we've just had. Now, we have been talking about everything that's been going on in the news at the local level, county and state level, the national level, even the international level, when we talk about what's happening in the Middle East, China, Iran, Ukraine, etc. But what we haven't talked so much about is how 2024 changed your life, your individual life, your personal life. What changed for you in 2024? Maybe you set a New Year's resolution and you actually kept it. Most people don't. Maybe you set a goal at work and you attained it. Maybe you set a challenge for you when it came to your personal health, and you met that challenge. maybe you told yourself you wanted to make great strides forward in your spiritual life, and you made those steps. So what we're going to do for part of our last hour here is take your comments either by phone or by text of how 2024, what changed for you in 2024? What changed in your life this year? And since this is the last day of the year, this is as close as we can come to the end of 2024. So call or text me at 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. Now, I'll ask Philip J. and radio legend Mark Christopher if they want to contribute their thoughts to this. I'll go ahead and kick it off. I set two goals for myself in 2024, and happily, I attained them. There's more to do, but I had to meet these goals. The first goal, I actually talked about a couple of weeks ago. I had been gaining weight steadily since COVID. You either lost a lot of weight and got in the best shape of your life during COVID because you were at home and you could work out, or your eating habits and your workout routine went away because of COVID, couldn't get to the gym, restrictions, etc., and you got in worse shape. I'm in the second category. And this summer, I weighed more than I've ever weighed before. Well over 200 pounds. And so I went on a diet. I looked around for a long time to find just the right diet because I didn't want to take any pills or have any injections. I didn't want to take drugs. I didn't want to go hungry because I knew that wouldn't work. And I didn't want to eat food that tasted like cardboard. And I found a diet called the Fast Metabolism Diet. We had Haley Pomeroy, the nutritionist who's behind this, wrote a best-selling book about it, where you can eat delicious food and still lose weight by changing how your metabolism works. And I'm not going to go into any details. We do that on another show at another time. But I ended up losing over 28 pounds. I had wanted to lose at least 20. And then I said, well, I wonder if I can hit 25. Now I'm wondering if I could hit 30. So that was one goal. Lose weight and keep it off. And so far, that is happening. The second thing I did is arguably among the most important things I've done. There is a program out there called Bible in a Year. So this is the spiritual side of my life. And I have read the Bible before, different versions of the Bible. This is a program, you could Google it, Bible in a Year, and you can do the program. It's on YouTube every year for 365 days, where you download a reading program and they calibrate the readings so that they complement each other, which is no easy feat with the Bible. And then you do a daily reading followed by, you can read along with Father Mike Schmitz, who does the Bible in a Year. It, for a time, was America's most popular podcast when it debuted several years ago. And there's a short prayer, and then he does kind of a mini sermon or a summary or, you know, a deep dive into what you had just read that day. So you had to do this every day. It goes anywhere from like 15 to 30 minutes.
Okay. So you kind of do the homework assignment, and then you listen to the podcast discussion about what you just read?
Or you can read along with him.
Okay.
But he reads it really fast.
Goes through what you were kind of given as a passage or an assignment to read. Yeah.
So it would take me more like 45 minutes or an hour a day, which is not easy for me with my schedule being what it is. But I wanted to do it. And I started last December, and I finished it a couple of weeks ago. And I learned more from Bible in a Year about the Bible, about Scripture, than I have learned from the reading the Bible three previous times combined. So this was a good use of my time. And I highly recommend the program to you. If you're curious, you say, you know, how can I deepen my spiritual commitment and my relationship with God? A more full, insightful understanding of the Bible is a great place to make that happen. So anyway, lost a lot of weight, kept it off, and did Bible in a Year. So that was for me what was different in 2024. What about Philip J.?
I guess one for me would be my folks. They're in their 80s and they're ready to downsize from the house in University Place that I was born and raised in. They brought me home from the hospital in.
Hmm.
And so we have begun this process of trying to find a place that's going to be suitable for them, would be closer to my wife and me up in North Seattle or maybe Southern Snohomish County, Northern King County, something like that. So we're going through that process. So that is ramped up here the last couple of months as we talk about what fits their needs and, you know, finding new doctors and things like that between Tacoma and now up here on the north side of Seattle. Exactly. So that would be one for me.
All right.
Something's changing for me. And let me start off with this great text from a listener that heard your call for answers to this on our text line 206-421-5757. Dave in Marysville texted us and said, in 2024, I found my biological mom after 51 years.
Wow.
Called her out of the blue one day. She was so happy, was so cool, and we have talked every day since, and I think we always will. So how's that for an answer?
Isn't that something?
Life, kind of life-changing, life-affirming answer.
Again, if you're just
congrats
joining.
Congrats to Dave and bio mom. Hi. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, what we're doing for part of our last hour of 2024 on the Commute with Carlson is we are asking people, what did you do? What changed in your life? We talk about everything happening that affects us, you know, around us, state, local, federal, national, international. But what in your own life changed? And of course, the other change that that came to us rather than happening from us was, you know, mom leaving us, passing on to heaven back in late November. So if there's anything that you did that changed in any way your life, on the physical side, spiritual, career-wise, family-wise, let us know. 206-421-5757. You can call or you can just text your comments. That's a big one.
That is a big one.
51 years. She reaches out and establishes contact with her birth mom.
Yeah, his birth mom.
Oh, his birth mom.
Yeah,
his birth mom.
And I'll just say, watch in 2025 what happens in your life.
Yeah.
As you made that connection. Okay, so this is strange, John, as you were sharing, and Phil, and everybody, as you start texting in here about the highlight of 2024 in the new year, these weird clouds are just kind of covered up with color of pink and orange here, and a bit of yellow over the Puget Sound, kind of like, okay, this is the clouds going to push out 24 and bring 25. John and Phil and everybody listening, if you would have told me 10 years ago that in 2024, 25 New Year's, I would be doing talk radio in Seattle with a legendary John Carlson, longtime producer, Philip J., who also produced for a dear friend of mine who went to Ballard High when I was at Queen Anne, Dory Monson. Mm. I would have said, lay your money on the table. I'm going to win this bet. Not going to happen. And I bring this up because a few days ago, December 10th, an individual who probably changed my whole world of radio passed away. Let me explain. We were going, finishing up 2014. I was at Warm FM, the Christmas station. John, it was one of those stations, and Phil, you know, I was having a ball. We've got Sally, who works here now. She remembers the days. I was like, highly, you know, MC, Mark, we need another host down here. And you know, advertisers, like, let's get Mark Christopher. So I was doing real good. Well, it's show business. But what happened was New Year's Day was on a Thursday. I didn't work. Friday, some of the staff wanted time off, and they said, Mark, will you do the morning show? Sure. And I thought it'd be kind of fun to bring on the amazing Kreskin. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
TV. Now, he always said, Mark, I'm not a psychic. I'm a mentalist. But in 10 years ago, he was making a comeback. I was one of seven people who said, I'll do an interview with you. How about Friday morning, 9:15, January 2nd of 2015? We'll talk about the year. I said, okay. Amazing Kreskin, by the way, just passed away here about 12 days ago. So this brings it to mind. I have about a 96% show up for interviews.
Sure.
9:15, I'm promoting it all morning. Amazing Kreskin is coming back. We're going to do this. He was a no-show.
Oh.
Okay. My show ended at 10 o'clock. I was asked to go into an office. Again, most people had the day off, and I was excused from my duty. No contract renewal, whatever. Very shocked.
Wow.
So I said, can I at least come back Monday, say goodbye to our friend Sally, who works here now, and others that were just dear friends. And I found out that at the front desk, I won't give a name because she's still in the area, and I owe her a big thanks. This woman said, Mark, can I just do something for you? And I go, what? And she goes, on the side through Family Heritage, I read cards. And I went, tarot cards and all that? No, just cards. It's just a skill I have, and I do some celebrities. I'm not going to reveal any, but I'm just curious about you because you're so happy all the time, so positive, you're Northwest. So I said, okay, sit down. In those cards readings that we did a week later, she says, you are still going to be in radio, but it's going to be a total change. Music's going to go away. You're going to be very uncomfortable at first, but hang with it. You're going to have a lot of fun with it, and it will keep you in radio. And you're going to meet a lot of dear friends that you already know, but you'll open up a whole new side of radio. And I just laughed at her. And she said, it'll happen in threes. 3 hours, 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months. Well, about 3 months later, I was asked, because she told me, you're going to be asked to go on a trip, a very unusual trip. You won't want to go, but go on it, because this is going to be part of how it all comes about. And I had to help my brother. 3 months later, all of a sudden, he got a job offer at Lake Havasu, Arizona. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll move you. And then I realized, is this the trip? When I got to Lake Havasu 5 days after moving my brother, the phone rang. It was a program director from Como Radio saying, Mark, you don't know me. We've been big fans of your music radio. You ever thought of News Talk? And I went, uh-oh. I said, okay, let's have an interview. Long story short, came in for a day of training. I said, there's no way. I got to play the hits. Well, don't worry about the hits. The hits will be reporters. You just play their stories. So I gave it a second chance. It worked out. Then came the commute with Carlson. You guys needed some help. Sound. Somebody to contribute some stories. I remember you guys, and you're looking at me like, there's no way. And look at it. 10 years now. So thank you, amazing Kreskin, for not showing up. Oh, by the way, I got a hold of his publicist a week after I got fired. I said, Kreskin, no show. What happened? He goes, Mark, it was really weird. You were the seventh interview. He was late on the sixth one. But he said, you know that Mark Christopher in Seattle? Don't worry about it. There's something weird where he's not going to be there much longer. So I learned in radio... Don't ask a mentalist or a psychic, maybe as a guest, and ask for your prediction of, what do you see in my future?
Wow.
Love you guys. Listeners, I love you for making it work here. I'm having a ball.
Oh, great. And
it's all on the journey.
Philip J. Vandervoort III, right around the corner, his favorite segment of the day, his last one of the year, social media from socialists, as the commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Angel, it's the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, Philip J. Vandervoort III's favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists. Go, Phil.
All right, the socialists are saying adios 2024. Hola, 2020.
It has not been a good year for them.
Yeah, it certainly didn't end
very
well.
Socialists are even crankier than usual at the end of 2024.
And the Twitter 20, I heard it on the X, a social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Let's start with a post by TheHill.com, and it involves a congressional Democrat, Jasmine Crockett from Texas. And Crockett has been taking aim at Democrats in the House Minority Caucus for choosing Representative Jerry Connolly of Virginia over Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to be the top Democrat in the House Oversight and Accountability Committee. And she's complaining that Democrats are choosing seniority over those who are best equipped.
Best equipped to what?
Yeah, I guess that's all kind of relative.
I'm sorry, we want a real member of Congress, not a Twitter celebrity who happened to be elected from a heavily Democrat district in the Bronx.
But this is generally how it goes. I'm sure that there are probably exceptions we could look back on in time, but generally that's how these committee assignments come up. You've been there longer. You've served more time.
You've put,
that's
you've
generally
paid your
the way
dues.
It goes. Exactly. And so I believe that Jasmine Crockett's a relatively new member of Congress.
Oh, she's a squad wannabe.
Yeah. So, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been there, what, six, seven, 8 years now, maybe?
Yeah. About she's in her, finishing her third or fourth term.
Yeah. Jasmine Crockett has been there a little bit less than that. So, you know, there's the youngsters that are trying to push out some of the older Democratic members. And, you know, this has been a downfall for Democrats with Biden running for
the Democrats
president as well.
Are going to have a reckoning over the influence of the far left, which helped lose them the election. Yeah. This is what Adam Smith is saying. Hey, we've gone too far left. We've left America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Pramila Jayapal, oh, no, we didn't go far left enough. We didn't show a deep enough contrast. That's why we lost.
Yeah. The social media handle Working Families Party, their profile says, we're a progressive grassroots political party of working people to transform America. They're a union group, basically. Probably a union front group. I'll read between
union
the lines
militants.
Here.
Union militants. Okay, get it.
And they posted, and this is kind of a frequent meme where you get a screenshot of the Simpsons TV show with Lisa Simpson standing in front of a giant movie projector screen, and then you get to write whatever message you want on the movie screen, like Lisa Simpson's up there giving a lecture or a TED Talk or something like that. And the message on the projector screen with Lisa Simpson says, arguing against living wages for everyone is arguing that some people deserve poverty. Nobody deserves poverty. And this is, you know, such a common attempt and flawed thinking. But this living wage as the minimum wage is the general concept here. Why would anyone ever go to a trade school? Why would anyone bother to graduate high school? Why would anybody bother to enter an apprenticeship program or go to college? If you're going to get rewarded for doing nothing, why would anyone try to improve her or himself? And that's kind of the integral part of what they're saying. Arguing against living wages for everyone is arguing that some people deserve poverty. Well, if you have poverty skills, you'll probably get what are, I think, loosely described by the Working Families Party and these pro-union activists as poverty wages.
Okay, well, let me.
But where's the incentive?
Let me ask a very serious question of this person. We should invite her on the air.
Well, yeah.
Because here is my very serious question to her.
Yeah.
If you're healthy and able-bodied and you don't want to work,
mm-hmm.
why shouldn't you be in poverty?
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you're able-bodied and you have the capacity to work and you simply don't want to work, why shouldn't you end up in poverty?
Yeah. This is what the economic intellectualists on the political left always seem to come up with.
That's even in the Bible, for crying out loud. Those who will not work should not eat.
I mean,
come on.
One final look at our Happy New Year's 2025 map. Happy New Year, Hong Kong, Manila, Philippines, Perth, Australia, Western Australia. One of the next to come up in 30 minutes, it'll be Happy New Year in Bangkok, Thailand.
Oh, how about
that? That's what's coming up
next.
That's
what I've been waiting for. Yeah. All right. Still to come on the Commute with Carlson. Again, this is just something we decided to do. We've never done before. We decided to ask for the last part of the last hour of the show. Hey, we know how things changed around the world and in this country and, you know, the state. But what about in your life? What changed for you in 2024? And boy, are we getting some interesting comments. We'll share them with you right around the corner as the Commute with Carlson continues. It's 8:31. 24 minutes to 9 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. So one of the things we thought we'd do is, you know, we've spent the entire year talking about how things are impacting our lives from outside. You know, what's changing in our country, what's changing in our state, what's changing in our city, what's changing in the world. So what about KVI listeners? What's changing in their lives? And so we put out the call for you to tell us what's changed for you in 2024. And here's some of the responses we're getting. Ed in Oak Harbor. I lost my wife of 54 years in September, completely upending my life. And the November 5th election, a sad year, my saddest ever. But what a gratifying election result also. KVI listener John in Pierce County. In 2024, what changed was I got a divorce, then bought my dream property. Still to come, details on how that all works for him going forward. A KVI listener in the 360 area code. I had an emergency triple bypass in the beginning of January. Divine intervention is the only thing that could have placed me at the right time and place where I could be diagnosed before the life-ending heart attack that was waiting to happen. My faith is strong. I'm truly blessed. My wife is my rock. Sometimes a brush with health helps you have a deepened appreciation for what you already have. And there's an example of it right there. I'm healthy, strong, and ready to retire in the next year. Look out, America. My bucket list of places to visit is long. I intend to see them all. Again, these are KVI listeners. We're putting out the call for you to either call us or text us with what changed for you personally in 2024, especially if it was change that you helped make. A KVI listener in the 253 area code. My wife retired, getting us one step closer to moving out of Washington. Oh, boy. There's someone who's probably got Kirby Wilbur on speed dial. Right.
Understand you're going to move. Just don't stop listening to the John Carlson show.
You can keep listening. You can keep listening to us on KVI.com, even if you feel the pull to leave. A anonymous conservative in Seattle writes, 2024, first grandchildren, twins. So that's a
it'll be fun.
Life changing.
That's going to be fun.
You know my theory, parents really don't spoil their kids. Grandparents spoil their grandchildren. That's how we end up with spoiled, a spoiled generation. Okay, we'll get to more of your comments later. But we're asking, you know, what changed for you, especially if it was change that you helped make, you know, a goal you set, an obstacle you overcame, whether it's in your job, your personal life, your social life. Maybe you made, a move. By the way, here is a case of someone who might be one of Seattle's most notorious homeless people. They wish that he would change things in his life. We've talked to you about him before. His name is Jose Rizal. This is the guy who, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't this the guy who took the, not the bulldozer,
but the excavator,
but
basically?
The excavator.
Yeah, like a skid steer or something like that.
And managed to get it started and commandeered it. It was driving it throughout a park and
wanted to build like a house up
damaging
there.
Property.
Yeah, Capitol Hill.
Anyway, he always is a public nuisance, always creates problems wherever he goes, so much so that there has been a court order banning him from all city parks. A court order, Jose Rizal, this is the place where he hangs out at, Jose Rizal Park. And he's not only frequenting parks again, but he's going back to that very park on the north end of Beacon Hill that overlooks the south of downtown area. It's right near the interchange of I-5 and I-90. He was arrested and ordered to stay away from all city parks for 10 years. His name is Steve Irwin, and neighbors say he is back and making trouble again.
Seattle police were called to Jose Rizal Park on Friday after witnesses reported seeing a homeless man who has made his mark in that park. Steve Irwin was linked to major property damage with a stolen excavator last year. He is also banned from all city parks for 10 years. On Friday, police did not find Irwin, but they did find an elaborate camp with gasoline and generators. Irwin pleaded guilty to malicious mischief last month and was sentenced to 4 months, but was released December 6th for time served.
Again, why do prosecutors give breaks to people who have been given breaks in the past and have abused them? Why would you give a break to someone and you reduce his jail term when he is made it clear whenever he's out, he's making trouble? But this happens constantly in Seattle. Remember the story we did on the guy who had cut through 5 ankle bracelets because judges didn't want to send him to juvie jail, to the Juvenile Justice Center? So they keep putting him on home monitoring. He keeps cutting through the bracelets, and they simply say, well, okay, here's another bracelet. Why do they do that? Yeah, I'll tell you what we need is an initiative that says, you know what, no more. After a certain time, no more breaks.
And this just is another example of the chronic repeat offenders that Seattle has either cultivated or decided that they just don't want to deal with.
So here we go. We've got another flurry of text messages coming in. KVI listener Siobhan in Tacoma says, after years of drug addiction, I have a year clean and sober, and I'm raising my son full-time again. So she got her sobriety back, and she got her son back.
Right on, Mom.
There you go. Siobhan, great having you as a listener. Well done. Have another great year in 2025. Mary from Lake Forest Park. What changed for me was, for the first time in my life, I made a donation to a political candidate. I donated a total of $700 to Donald Trump for president because I truly felt this was the most important election of my lifetime. I didn't look or hear the results of the election for 2 days because I was too scared. Instead, this country gave me a wonderful Christmas present. Wow. She didn't look or hear the results of the election for 2 days?
With the anticipation of what could have happened, not or taking that much time to find out the answer.
Oh, man. Thank goodness it went the right way.
And we know there was a lot of that going on. People, even I know, I got to do something. I got to give to a campaign. I've never done that in my life. And there was a lot, John, we found out here. A lot of people said they've never voted before. They just said, just let it go. I live in Washington. I know which way it's going to go. I have no chance. But they voted anyway.
Yeah. And you know what? I've seen that a lot. I gave to a candidate for the first time in my life. There's just something about 2024 brought that out in people. Let's squeeze in one more here if we can. In the 425 area code, anonymous KVI listener, 2024, after living in the same house in Old Town Snoqualmie for 40 years, I sold it. Originally, the property taxes were $700 a year. When I sold it, they were $700 a month. Oh, man. 2025 is going to be a great year. Good riddance to King County. All right, we'll stay. If you don't stay in the 425 area code, stay with us here. All right. When we are back, our final segment of 2024, we'll be joined by our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson. How about that? The Commute with Carlson, continuing Talk Radio 570 KVI. Minutes to 9 o'clock, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hey, there is a bowl game, and the University of Washington Huskies are playing in it. Hey, Matthew, what do you see? Do their faces, do you know their names? Hey, hey, Matthew, what do you see? Oh, what do you see? Matthew Carlson joining us this morning on the John Carlson Show, our senior sports correspondent, telling us who looks like the favored team in the Participation Ribbon Bowl that the Huskies are playing in, what, San Diego, I think. At least the weather's probably going to be good.
I see the sun. It's the Sun Bowl in El Paso, Texas.
That's right.
The Sun Bowl.
It was the Cougars who played in San Diego. El Paso, Texas. Yep. All right. Matthew Carlson.
El Paso, Texas, 11 o'clock on CBS.
11 o'clock this morning on Channel 7, CBS.
Mm-hmm.
The Huskies playing Louisville.
And Louisville, or Louisville, depending who you talk to.
Yeah. Okay, so what is at stake in this game? Again, we've been having some fun calling it the Participation Ribbon Bowl, given what's at stake. But the Huskies, you know, kind of, you know, made their way through, you know, a tough season. They started with, I think, one starter.
Yeah, the Huskies, with the college football playoff and the changes and everything, these bowl games have taken on kind of a neutered position in the college football landscape. However, it's always nice to go on top of winter of the season. The Huskies, like you said, have had to battle through a lot of adversity. Only one returning starter, you know, out of 22 on offense and defense. They muscled their way through a 6-6 season, had some marquee moments like beating Michigan at home.
Yes, that felt cool. Good.
That was pretty cool in a rematch of the national championship.
I tell you what, we are really, really tight on time. If there was a sports story in 2024 that you would say is the biggest sports story of the year, what would it be, Matthew Carlson?
Oh, shoot. I got five quick ones. I got Caitlin Clark, Scottie Scheffler, Shohei Ohtani, Simone Biles at the Olympics. But the biggest thing, best NFL coach and best college coach in history, Saban and Belichick retiring. Pretty big deal.
Saban and Belichick retire. That's all the time we got. Thank you very much, Matthew Carlson. Happy New Year.